You got a Bible, turn to John chapter 11. I had asked Melissa if she would read John 12 because it's Palm Sunday. And John 12, of course, is John's account of this amazing day when Jesus would go into Jerusalem and the crowds would gather and palm branches and their coats and they would sing Hosanna and all that was associated with that event would take place. But I wanted you just to be reminded that the context even of that incredible moment is actually the miracle that takes place around Lazarus. Did you hear how John wove that in? Like, the crowd is there because they are talking about Lazarus and they are telling people about Lazarus. The enemies of Jesus are there and they are wanting to put Lazarus to death also. In other words, not only do they want Jesus dead, they want Lazarus dead. They're just desperately trying to stamp out this groundswell of enthusiasm and interest and even belief in Jesus. And it's almost sort of like this thing that's growing out of control and they're just desperate to try to stop it. And so much of it is born out of what takes place in John chapter 11 as the truth of who Jesus is becomes incredibly clear. And I think that's a big part of what this story is about and a big reason why this is such an important moment in the life of ministry of Jesus. All through the Gospel of John, we've kind of been building in this direction, right? John tells us in chapter 1 that Jesus is the Word and the Word became flesh and we have seen his glory, right? So it starts off with glory and it's just building and building and building. And by chapter 11, we'll see a couple points where Jesus said, hey, all of this is taking place to reveal to you my glory. The pinnacle of Christ's glory, of course, is the fact that he will go to the cross. And he will rise from the tomb. But here in John 11, we get this incredible, unusual story that's going to help us see the glory of Jesus. Last week, we spent the whole Sunday building up to what I said was going to be 7 observations, only I never got to them, which is a terrible way to preach. It's like, hey, I'm going to 7 points. And oh, by the way, we'll do them next week. But what we did instead was worked our way through the whole chapter. So I'm not going to read it again this week. So I do apologize if you weren't here last week. We read all through most of chapter 11 to kind of see a story unfold that kind of goes something like this. There's a man named Lazarus who is ill, gravely ill apparently, because his sisters Martha and Mary are so concerned that they send word to Jesus to get Jesus to come, presumably to heal him. You imagine that's what they have in mind. Send for Jesus. Why send for Jesus? Well, because Jesus has healed people. And so perhaps if Jesus comes, he can heal Lazarus. Jesus doesn't get there in time. By the time Jesus gets there, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. And in the ancient world, 4 days dead is really dead. I know that sounds funny. Listen to last week's sermon if you want to hear more explanation of that. But that's kind of the point of the story. There's just no more hope at 4 days. So Jesus arrives late, seemingly, to the scene. Both Martha and Mary both say the same thing to him. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Like, they just have this confidence that Jesus actually could have made a difference. He just didn't get there in time. There's lots of weeping. There's lots of mourning, as appropriate with what we realize we've stepped into in John 11, a funeral that's actually taking place before our eyes. Jesus weeps. He is agitated. He comes before the tomb. He says, roll back the stone. And everyone's response is like, Jesus, like, are you sure that's a good idea? We're 4 days in. But they do. And he says, Lazarus, come forth. And he does. And Jesus raises a man from the dead. That's kind of the story. It's an awesome story. Like, just that is a spectacular, amazing moment in human history. The only strange part is I left out 7 details. 7 details, as I read through the story, are like moments where you just kind of are left scratching your head of like, well, that's kind of the story in a nutshell. But when you add these other 7 parts to it, you're like, I didn't see that coming. That's a strange feature of the story. And so what I want to do this morning is walk through these 7 things to see I'm going to say the oddity, but I would suggest to you that the odd parts of the story are actually the point of the story. The way it's told, the way John recounts what takes place is to help us see things and to stop along the way and to have that jarring sort of moment where you go, what is going on here in this otherwise seemingly amazing but kind of seamless story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead? So here we go. Seven things, picking up from last week. And I'm not going to, as I mentioned, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but I will definitely point you to some things along the way and read a few verses as we go. Verse 3, item number 1, Jesus loved this family. He loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. It says so in black and white. The sisters sent to him saying, "Lord, he whom you loved is ill." Now, presumably, they didn't just make that up. They must have known that Jesus loved Lazarus. You see down in verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Later on, I think it's around verse 35 or something, as Jesus is weeping and is agitated over the scene at the tomb, all the crowd looks at Jesus and says, "See how he loved him." In other words, they're interpreting everything they see Jesus doing, the emotion he's experiencing, as evidence of the love that Jesus has for this family. And so we would be right to conclude we are watching Jesus love someone. I mentioned last week that I grew up with this little song. Many of you did as well. "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." And you never really had to think much of maybe beyond that. But this story forces us to ask a question. What then does the love of Jesus look like? And here's why. Odd detail number 1. Because Jesus loved them so much, verse 5 says, "Therefore, when he heard Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place he was." That's upside down, isn't it? Like if you heard someone you loved was ill, isn't the expected response drop everything and go to see them? Not because you love them, you went to work the next day, you thought maybe about going, but you weren't really sure. You let 48 hours go by. And Jesus knows all things. He knows as he's letting this time go by, Lazarus is dying. And because Jesus loved them, he waited. I hope you see how odd that is. Because doesn't that sort of translate into, because Jesus loves me and loves you, that it is possible he may not do the thing that you would expect? Even though you might be able to look and say, "Well, Jesus, I know the most obvious thing. Here's my situation. Here's my diagnosis. Here's my need for a job. Here's the hard thing going on in my life. And because you love me, you ought to do the thing that I need." And we all know what the thing is that I need, because in this story, it's obvious. Jesus should come, heal Lazarus, and they all live happily ever after. And he doesn't. Is it possible that the way Jesus displays his love for us is by giving us the thing that we actually need more than anything else? I'm not going to build a case and say the way Jesus shows his love for us is by doing something that we don't need. He does the thing that we need more than perhaps we've even realized. He shows us his glory. He helps us understand who he is. And Jesus will show this family his love by waiting 2 days to show them more of who he is in a way that otherwise they would have never been able to see. In 2008, and remember 2008? There's a name for 2008. The Great Financial Crisis. Anyone remember that? It was an interesting time. It hit in August of 2008. You want to know how I know that? It's because my house went up for sale on August 15th of 2008. Only we didn't know. I think I've told bits of this story. Like we didn't know it. Like the day the sign went up in my front lawn, it wasn't like, "Oh, this is going to be tricky. It's the Great Financial Crisis." No, it was like, something's going on in the world, but there's always things going on in the world. There goes the real estate sign. Because we had decided that God was calling us to go from the church we were pastoring to a different church in a different community. And so as an act of what seemed and felt like, and I still believe to this day, to be obedience. It's like you gotta, when you're moving, you kind of have to sell one house because you're gonna presumably buy another house. So sign goes up. And I remember a couple conversations, there was more than one, at the price. It was sort of like, Because, you know, you get the MLS, so everyone can go on and see what your house is worth. Fantastic. You can go spy on each other. It's a fantastic hobby. And not creepy at all, right? So I remember a couple of conversations with the price that people were like, huh, we would have thought your house was easily worth $100,000 more. I'm like, I don't know, but the real estate agent said things are just kind of, market's sort of soft, not much is happening, so this is the price they suggested. Yeah, okay, fair enough, it was still reasonable. Within a week, I remember the conversation with the real estate agent. He's like, I don't know all what's going on, but it's not good out there right now. Nothing's selling. I'm going to suggest a price drop. There went the second 100,000. And I remember at that point, it's like, huh, well, this is interesting. You know, there's like the original thought of maybe what it should have been and then what it is and now what it's become. But still not quite panic yet. The panic would come in the story. Because as the weeks roll on, and even at the reduced price, there was still, people weren't knocking down our door to try to buy our house. And I remember the next price drop. The next one was only 50,000, because by that point, it's like, you know, here, you want the keys. Sort of how it felt. And I remember struggling a little bit through this time. Actually, a lot. My wife's in nursery, so she could tell you the real truth. Because in my mind, it worked something like this. When God calls you and you obey, then God does really great things for you, right? That's sort of more of the scenario. It's like, okay, God, we're going to leave a place we love and people we love. We're going to go to this new place and we don't know them yet. So how can we love them yet? Because it's all new. But, and so that's hard. And so Jesus is going to compensate, right? By showing his love, by like doing awesome things in the real estate market. So now the price is down, what are we, 150 down? Then out of the blue, along comes this couple. And we never met them. It was all just transactional, their agent, our agent. They offered way above asking price. Like, oh, Jesus, isn't that just the way it is with you? When at the lowest point, you come in and go, see, Don, I did love you. Look at this. Part of the challenge of the great financial crisis for those who were not really paying attention, like if you weren't, it was sort of a blip for lots. It was like, oh, that was interesting. If you were selling a house, it was like a painful blip. People couldn't get financing. And so this couple who offered like a reasonable amount ended up coming back and saying, sorry, we can't actually close the deal. Like, oh, Jesus, I didn't see that one coming. The house sold for less than the final asking price. But I remember a Sunday in late October, before that it all happened and all the dust had settled, the circumstances were still tricky. Being in a church service, and I don't remember the name of the song, but the song that was sung that day had two key themes to it. One is the greatness of God and the other was the goodness of God. And I remember standing there, I don't know if there were tears coming down my face or not, maybe. And just realizing God still loves me. He's still great and he's still good. And the circumstances going on had nothing to do with that. Now, here's what's really interesting to me about that moment. By that point, nothing circumstantially had changed. Just God in his grace showed me, reminded me of his care. And that was enough. Now, I'm not the hero of the story. I'm the guy who doubted the whole way through, who wrestled with God, who was frustrated. But as I think of this story, at the point we're in John chapter 11, nothing has changed yet. Jesus has delayed, precisely because he wants to be able to come, precisely because he wants to be able to teach this family and those around them that he's glorious and he's good. And it's not going to be entirely dependent on the circumstances. And if you're going to follow Jesus, which I hope you are, you need to know that when you sing, Jesus loves me, this I know, his primary commitment is for you to see and understand his glory. Number one. Number two. Comes in verse 4. So I kind of get it. We're kind of bouncing around a little bit here. Verse 4, we read this. Jesus, when he heard about Lazarus, said, this illness does not lead to death. In other words, the final the final part of this is not a death part. It's for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, it's similar to the first part in that in the love of Jesus for us, for them, he leads us to understand more of his glory. But there's a slight nuance to it, a little bit different aspect to it. Because if you think of the whole story, the whole scope of it, the way John tells it, the story doesn't end with Lazarus comes forth and Lazarus comes out of the tomb and they undo the fabric and they carry on. The story actually continues. Do you notice that? Now, in most English Bibles, there's little headings, right, that are helpful. They're usually very, very helpful things because they give us kind of a clue of what's going on. They're not actually part of the text. So John didn't write, you know, above verse 38, Jesus raises Lazarus. He just tells us that so we can kind of get some pointers. He didn't write above verse 45, the plot to kill Jesus, as though this is somehow a new story. It's all part of the same story. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. Verse 45, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him, because that's kind of what you do when you see a dead person come to life. The person who raises them from the dead feels like a pretty compelling person, and so they believe. But, verse 46, here's an unexpected part. Some of them went to the Pharisees, told them what Jesus did, so the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? This man performs many signs, and if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. Never once entertaining the possibility that maybe they should have believed as well. Nope, they just skip right to, then we should probably kill him, because what does the high priest say? Caiaphas, the high priest, in verse 49 says, you know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. This actually is the story that sets the stage for Jesus to be killed. He starts by telling us, this illness does not lead to death. But Lazarus dies. Now he's raised from the dead. But the story continues to Jesus. And Jesus dies, but doesn't remain dead. You see what John's wanting you to see? If you want to understand the glory of Jesus, you have to get to the cross and you have to get to the tomb. That's the only place where you understand how great and glorious Jesus truly is. And Jesus says, that's why this story is happening, so that you can understand who I am. Number three, Jesus tells his disciples that he is glad Lazarus died. I don't know if you've ever had one of those moments where someone tells you, they deliver news or say something, and about halfway through, what they've said is so unusual or shocking or hard that you don't hear what comes next. I've had that moment more than once. It's usually my wife when saying something. It's like I've stopped halfway through the sentence and realized, oh, I missed what was coming next. I suspect when Jesus said to his disciples, as he does in verse 14, here's what he says to them, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad. That right about there, whatever came next was really hard to catch. Because this is my tip from last week. If you ever show up at a funeral and say, hey, I'm really glad that person died, you're going to realize that news, that message, that whatever comes next in the statement didn't get heard. But Jesus tells them he is glad. Why? Well, he actually does explain in the rest of the statement. For your sake, I'm glad that I was not there so that you may believe. In other words, the fact that I wasn't there to heal him meant that he died, and I was glad I wasn't there, because there's something you need to believe. Now, what is it that he needed them to believe? We'll get to that in the next point, but spoiler alert, he wants them to believe that he is the resurrection and life, that he has power over death itself, and he's glad. Otherwise, they never would have seen it. Now, I ran into a quote years ago from Henry Blackaby, who wrote a book called Experiencing God. Always drew me this little quote. I'm going to read part of it. I'm going to skip pieces, so I'll try to thread it together in a way that makes sense. He just talks about wrestling with this very story and the fact that Jesus does what he does and it's described the way it is. Here's what he says. The Spirit of God began to help me understand something. It seemed to me that if Jesus had said to Mary and Martha, you are exactly right. If I had come, your brother would not have died. You know that I could have healed him because you've seen me heal many times. And if I had come when you asked, I would have healed him. But you would have never known any more about me than you already know. Had they sent the messenger, here's what he's saying. Had they sent the messenger and Jesus had come, Jesus would have healed him. Would they have known any more of the glory of Jesus? They already knew he could heal. That's why they were calling for Jesus in the first place. They would have learned and known nothing more about Jesus. But he goes on and he says, all along Jesus' response is puzzling. To his disciples, he says, Lazarus has died and for your sake, I'm glad I was not there. Really? A friend has died and you're glad? That's confusing, except that allows them to learn something new about Jesus. He's a resurrection and life. That's different than just healing. That's a new thing they're about to learn about Jesus. That's the third thing. Jesus sometimes does unexpected things that we learn more about him. Number four, Jesus, in the face of immense grief and agony, draws attention to himself. Again, strange, in essence. If you stepped into not even a situation, say, of death, but into a situation of difficulty, someone that you know and love and care for is going through a hard thing, can you imagine for a second just saying, hey, I've got the solution. You just need to focus all your attention on me. I hope you realize how bizarre and inappropriate that would be. And yet, it's exactly what Jesus does. Verse 17, when Jesus came, he found Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. Many of the Jews had come to Martha and to Mary to console them concerning their brothers. And I bet you their consolation of Mary and Martha was the way most of the time we console people. It's like, oh, you know, sorry for your loss. Lazarus was a great guy. Here's a casserole. All good things, by the way. As long as we don't stop there. Because Jesus is going to teach us that if we actually want to bring real consolation to those of us who have set our affections after him, we had better get to Jesus. He goes on. We find out that when Mary heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Still don't have a clue what she was asking, because later on, you realize in verse 39, she is not thinking resurrection from the dead for Lazarus, at least not until the end times. But she has this belief that Jesus could make a difference. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again, which is standard, correct Jewish theology first century. This is just what they believed. Yes. There is a resurrection. There is a general resurrection at the end of all time from the dead, and God will judge. And so you see, actually, Martha gets it, and she responds in verse 24, I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. So they're having a conversation basically about, like, what does Orthodox theology tell us? Jesus said there is resurrection. She's like, yep, I know. I've learned it from the time I was a little girl. There is resurrection on the end. This is not bad. This is good. This is belief. This is confidence. But Jesus in verse 25 doesn't just say, isn't that such good news that we can believe that? Or cheer your heart with the knowledge of a resurrection one day. You notice how strange it is what he says next. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. That's odd. You show up to a funeral and you say, I want you to focus on me. Because when it comes to life and resurrection, that's who I am. I used the strange example from D.A. Carson about Kentucky Fried Chicken last week, for those who weren't here. For me, it works. I don't know about the rest of you who don't like KFC, but you got to go back, because I know they maybe don't do commercials quite the same, but back in the day, KFC used to do commercials, and it was always the colonel. He was the face of the organization, and he would talk about the secret herbs and spices and the finger licking good and all that kind of stuff, right? And the big tubs of greasy fat stuff that went right to your arteries and all those kind of things. He didn't put that in the commercial. That you found out on your own. Right? And D.A. Carson's point was, if the colonel had said in one of those commercials, I am Kentucky Fried Chicken, it would be, he never did, but it would actually be a statement that I think we could understand what he was saying, making a claim about something. What would the claim mean? Well, he would probably be meaning that there is no KFC without me. I embody it. I created it. It's so intertwined with who I am that you take me away and there is no more KFC. In the same way, Jesus comes along and says, okay, we're talking about death and we're talking about life. I am the resurrection and I am the life. You take me out of the equation, Martha, there is no resurrection. There is no life. This end times thing that you are thinking of and affirming, which is true, it's like, I am it. If I don't show up, then there is no resurrection and life. It is all embodied in who I am. He goes on and he explains the two things. He said, I am the resurrection and I am the life, right? There's two claims being made there. And then look what he does next. He explains them briefly. Whoever believes in me, though he die, he shall live. That's resurrection. Die, live, resurrection. And then he goes on, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. That's life. And he turns to her and says, do you believe this? And you remember where we're at? We're at a funeral for a guy named Lazarus. Does it not strike you as odd that in the middle of the funeral, he's now talking to Martha about the things that she believes about life and death? Because it is a little bit unusual. Notice he's no longer talking about Lazarus. He's no longer just talking about just Mary and Martha. He's taken this way back. He started talking in verse 25. Whoever believes and everyone who believes. Like, this is way bigger. The claim just got huge in the middle of this story, where Jesus is inviting every person who will ever live, no matter where they live, when they live, to come to faith in the fact that he is the resurrection of life. And he turns to Martha and says, do you want to be the first to believe this? And she answers, and her answer is actually stunning. Martha's a great theologian. She says, yes, Lord, I believe. She doesn't stop there. She actually then sort of puts the pieces together. You are the Christ, the Son of God. She's looking back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. If you want to find out about the Messiah and the belief around the Messiah had to be the one that had control of life or death, because he's going to have a kingdom that never ends. And if you're going to have a kingdom that never ends, somehow you have to be triumphant over life and death itself. Otherwise, that doesn't work. And she puts all the pieces together in this one spectacular claim and gives us an example to follow. That every one of us has to come to this statement and say, do I believe that Jesus is the resurrection of life? If I do, yes, Lord, I believe. Number five. Is that where we're at? Nope, number four. Sorry. We'll pick up the pace. Number four. Jesus. Oh. Number five. We're doing better. Well, then I can actually talk about number four longer. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, let me for just a second, because sorry. I'll be honest. I'm very tempted with this story. I've always been tempted with this story to say, it's a great story, but Jesus raises him from the dead in just a few minutes. I'm very tempted to sort of say it doesn't count in a sense. Like, yes, it's a miracle. I don't mean it. I believe the miracle. I don't mean it doesn't count in that way. It's just like, but it's not like my life. Like, when Jesus steps in and it's like, yeah, they're mourning for 4 days. And then everyone knows, we read the story, Jesus raised from the dead. It's just not quite the same. And I'm very tempted at a number of levels just to kind of go, like, it doesn't quite translate into what we face in life and death, or the hardships or the difficulties we face. But I've been, this time through, as I've been thinking through this story for a few weeks now, realizing that in many ways, it is exactly our story. Because if you have faith in Jesus, your body will die. But will you not be raised from the dead? All it is then is just a difference in time. 4 days versus, I don't know what the time period would be, but it is actually not categorically a different thing at all. It's exactly the same thing. In fact, we are in a better position. You want to know why? Because Lazarus has to die again. He's going to die twice. I've had numerous people over the years, Christians like who love Jesus, who have said things like, I'm not really afraid of death. Like, I know Jesus has that covered. But the dying part, not totally sure of that. And I get that. I'm probably in the exact same category. Do I fear death? Like, no. Jesus has taken care of that. The dying to get there, Lazarus has to do it twice. You only have to do it once. And Jesus will raise you. Like, be just really quick to just, I guess what I'm saying is be quick to push this story aside and say, this is not the story of all of us. Jesus is the resurrection of life for me and for you if you put your faith in him. And we have nothing to fear. Okay, now, number five. The strange emotion of Jesus that's going to come from verse 28 to verse 38. Jesus weeps and he is deeply moved, most English translations say. I looked at this last week. I mentioned the fact that actually deeply moved is a terrible translation because it actually would more indicate that he's incredibly angry. Angry to the point where the word that's going to be used to describe it is actually he's actually snorting like an animal that is agitated and upset and angry. You can maybe picture like, you know, like I use the example of a bull, but any sort of animal when they get agitated will have this. And you're at the zoo and it's like, you know, look at the nice bear. They're making funny sounds. I wonder if he's trying to talk to me. It's like, no, no, he is agitated. And if there was not a gate, you know, right there, he would want to eat you. Right? It's that there is emotion coming out of Jesus that is strong. I guess that's the point. Very strong emotion coming out of Jesus. Now, there's been lots of different suggestions of why this is. Most of them are terrible. Let me give you a couple examples. One commentator says, Jesus weeps because he feels forced into doing a miracle and it breaks his heart. Like really? Are you reading the same Jesus I'm reading? Because that doesn't seem to be what's going on. Or other places where it's like he's angry because people aren't believing in him. As you read through the story, you have to find an appropriate explanation for the emotion, the anger, the tears. And the only one that I can think of, because I see it somewhere else where he weeps over the city of Jerusalem, there's strong emotion over it, over the lostness and the state, the devastation of sin and the cost of redemption. And I would say the same thing is going on at this moment right here. He stands and surveys the whole situation. There is a tomb and there are people grieving and there has been loss and there has been death. And what does he do? He does exactly what I think we would hope he would do. And say, this is just not the way it's supposed to be. And there are tears and there is anger because the world was not made to be this way. Sin and death is the enemy. I was at a funeral once. I was sitting near the back. I won't tell you what church. It was not a church that we would typically probably go to. And the minister got up and invited all the kids to the front. It was a little bit different. A bunch of kids, they all came to the front. And she told this story about this caterpillar that turned into a cocoon and then one day became a butterfly. And explained to the kids that death was nothing to be afraid of. Death was just this wonderful thing. It was just part of this beautiful, wonderful process. I remember sitting at the back and sitting on my hands because like, I want to jump up to the front of this church and explain that this is wrong. This is not what God's word teaches. Death is the enemy and Jesus had to come and die to be victorious over it. That's not something we celebrate as part of like the cocoon in the life cycle of a butterfly. And Jesus comes and I'm actually very thankful for this. He is angry. Now, I'm sure there is anger over the calamity, the price of sin. I'm sure there's angry over what the cost of redemption is going to be, that he's going to have to die. Like, I'm sure all that is baked in. But if you want to know the response of Jesus to death, you've got it right there in the middle of this story. And he's not a fan. It's the enemy. And he will defeat it. Number six, verse 40. I'll move quick because we're almost done. Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? Just notice the order. I guess that's maybe the only thing I want to point out, because I would have expected it would have been the opposite. Did not I tell you that if you see the glory of God, then you believe? In other words, if you arrive at the Grand Canyon and walk out and see it with your eyes, glory happens next, right? Like that. And a lot of times when we think about faith things, we usually end up feeling like, man, if we see things, we experience the glory up front, then we believe. And Jesus comes along and says, actually, the way it's going to work is the opposite of that. You're going to see glory because you believe in me. We're about to see it in the story. Like, it's the people who believe that are going to see Lazarus coming out of the tomb. Martha, who's like, I think you are the resurrection and life. She's going to watch her brother come out of a tomb. And he says to all of us, you, me, anyone who's put their faith in Jesus, when you believe in me, one day you are going to see glory that's going to blow your mind. Believe, see glory. Last, number 7. The story really points us to one spectacular, unexpected thing. That Jesus gives life, he's precisely through his death. He is going to give life to Lazarus. He's going to give life to you because he's going to give his own life for it. That's how the story ends. This whole weird sort of ending part of the Pharisees and Caiaphas. You notice there's a very strange verse, verse 51, that when Caiaphas says that one man should die so the whole nation doesn't perish, verse 51 says, he did not say this of his own accord. In other words, there is something else going on. And the wording of what comes next, this wording of prophecy, indicates that this is God who is taking a man who is not a righteous man and is speaking through him so we don't miss what's going on. And here's what the point was. Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather in to one, the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead as like a small example of what he does for all time. He gives his life so that there is resurrection and life, so that you can be forgiven and redeemed and live with him forever. John 11 wants you to know that, doesn't want you to miss that as you go into your Easter celebration. This is the center of the gospel, this great transaction of Jesus who will give you his righteousness and take your sin upon himself.